It is my great, great pleasure to just introduce the two people who will captivate you over the next hour or so. And we thank all of you. You've been off at seminars since 7:30 this morning. You've also braved, you know, uncharacteristic, unseasonal rain to be here. But this is going to be great fun tonight. And this is also a great personal pleasure for me because these are two wonderful friends of mine. In one of the other lives I have, I've had a dabbling interest in theater. And of all the people I've ever been exposed to in the United States or England in terms of classical theater, there is no one in the category of Michael Kahn. He is just remarkable. He has had...
But cannot seem to be able to put but he can't, in his belt.
Well, it's, you know, technology. It's a, but he has... He's really one of the most distinguished people in classical theater, not just in the country, but in the world. His career has taken him from off Broadway to off Broadway to Broadway to major theaters, not just in this country, but abroad. He is the artistic director of the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, which is by far the most distinguished classical theater in the United States. He has done productions as, not just in theater, but in opera, in major cities around the world. He is a champion of the classics. He has directed himself. I don't know that there's any tragedy or comedy or history of Shakespeare that he has not directed, but he is ecumenical. He has also directed from, you know, Sophocles to Ibsen to Molière. The definition of classics may be something we can talk about. Williams, Wilde, Johnson, Shaw, but not anybody makes it into Michael's canon. And perhaps he'll talk about that as well. He is also the Richard Rodgers Professor or Director of Acting at the Juilliard School, so he has been the mentor and inspiration for some of the greatest classical actors in the country, not just on stage, but in film. He's also the director of the Academy for Classical Acting in Washington. And he now has, at his young age, a new theater to fill and countless audiences to inspire with our own Sidney Harmon and the Harmon Center for the Arts, which will be opening in another year and a half or so. He will have yet another stage in Washington to captivate people with. So we are absolutely thrilled to have him here. Some of you were here last year. You saw Midsummer Night's Dream, a product of his theater. We hope to bring in the future in Aspen every summer a wonderful production. And the other thing about Michael is that he is passionate about the relevance of classics to everyone. And it's not just the elite. It's not just those who have gone to universities and had a chance to study and read Shakespeare and Corneille and Molière, but the public. And one of the most wonderful experiences that any of us who live in Washington can have is to go to the Carter Barron Theater in the summer, which is an outdoor amphitheater, and be exposed to wonderful classics that's free. And you see people coming into this amphitheater, many of whom have never been in any theater, and they see a classical production, and it's spellbound, it's spellbinding, and it's just a wonderful thing. And so he believes in access to everyone. So he is our special guest, but we also have an enormous treat in the person who's going to be introducing and moderating and involved in the conversation, in our own Ken Edelman, Aspen Zone, Washington Zone, who has had a very distinguished career. He was assistant to the Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He was our arms control negotiator. He was our ambassador to the United Nations. But throughout this period and thereafter, he's also been a very, very distinguished student of Shakespeare. He's taught Shakespeare, and he has also, with his wife, and for those of you who think that Republicans and even conservative Republicans don't appreciate women and the fact and their leadership, he is the vice president of his company, and his wife, Carol, is the president of the company. So, but their program, Movers and Shakespeares, is just a wonderful introduction to many companies, the Air Force, many organizations, about the lessons and values from Shakespeare in every aspect of life, and particularly for leaders. But most importantly, intriguingly, and I still haven't quite figured this out, in addition to all of that incredible resume and experiences, he was, and don't ask me to explain, he was the translator for Muhammad Ali in the Rumble in the Jungle, or whatever it was called, in 1975, the World Championship battle, and I don't know if we'll
and
get to that.
That was a classic.
That was a classic. That was a classic. Hamlet, Macbeth, but that was a classic. So we're delighted you're here, and it's all yours.
Thank you very much. I did, about 6 months ago, I gave a speech in Japan about security issue in Northeast Asia. And at the end of my speech, the head of the foreign affairs of Japan stood up and he said, Ambassador Edelman, for your remarks, you deserve much clap. I said, thank you very much. Of all of the things in the world I need much clap is not one of them. But I appreciate the sentiment. Let me just say before he goes that Elliot Gerson and putting together the Idea Fest is an unbelievable experience for all of us. So that is our first much clap. And our second is Michael Kahn. He has enriched our city of Washington, our nation's capital, in a way that is just very, very special and very appreciated. He came to Washington 19 years ago.
You're not. Oh.
I'm not going to do it again.
They're so tired of hearing about me.
A small theater. We've gone to a good theater, and now we're going to a great theater in the Harmon, named for Sidney Harmon and his generosity. So if you see Sidney in the next few days, thank him for that. It really is a tremendous accomplishment. So we're going to. I'm going to ask a few questions of Michael, and then just open it up. And you know, if you have, anybody has something burning, just burn and do it. And we're going to...
Hi, Dana. How are you?
Dana Gioia, welcome on this, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, who's done so incredibly much for the arts on this. Welcome for that. So I'm going to start it off, and if you can't hear, if one of us starts to mumble or something like that, just signal.
That'll be me. So.
That'll be Michael. So don't be shy about it. And we're very customer-oriented in this endeavor right here. Michael, let's start off grand, okay? And just tell us, in this day and age, what is the magic of theater? I mean, we can all turn on that television. We can all download a show on our iPods, which is a lot easier, if I may say, than schlepping to the theater and sitting there and not being able to walk out if we don't really like it. And doing all that. So what is there about theater that makes theater?
Well, I mean, I think it's different for everybody, but for me, I think it is something is happening in real time in a space with real people that will actually never happen that way again. And that there is a connection between the performers and the audience that actually makes...
Or maybe we'll amplify it, okay? Why don't we do that?
I just got back from Italy, so I'm talking like this. Actually, I could be talking to like this. All right. Everybody says I talk too quiet. I'll talk up like this. No, oh, you amplified it. Is that all right?
Yes.
Is that okay?
I can hear myself. That's really scary. I think the theater does a couple of things that are very special to theater. One of them is that it's actually live and you are there and what is happening in real time, and that the 1 hour, 1 hour and a half, or if you see one of my plays, the 4 hours.
Or 4.5.
Or 4.5 hours. Is happening in a very particular way on that particular night because of you and because of the response to the actors and you. So that it's an intimate experience and a very personal one. Also, I think when you go to a movie, I like going to movies, but I find myself, like I saw a very funny movie the other day, and I found myself not laughing out loud because I was in a place with a lot of strangers. And I find that when I'm in the theater, even though we're all separate, we are actually all together. So it's a genuinely communal experience. And I think you can celebrate. There's also a sense of danger in the theater because something could go wrong. Something could go particularly right. something could happen of certain brilliance tonight that may never have happened before. The scenery could fall down. An actor could forget their lines. The floor could open up. You've been to our theater. So that you're present at an experience that's being created while you're there. And even if it's been rehearsed, you know, and hopefully it's been rehearsed quite successfully, what is actually happening is actually happening in a very specific way for the first time and will never happen exactly that way again. I know that actors, when I direct, and then we'll talk about classics, I know that I don't direct a miniaturist. I don't say this moment has to be exactly like that and it has to be like that all the time. It's about knowing what's going on, about what's happening between the characters, and then allowing the temperature of the room, the temperature of the audience, certain feelings that you might bring with you from the day, certain things that might have happened in the world that make you see this moment in a play differently today than before. And those things come into a live performance. And it's participatory because you have to do some work. If you just sit there and don't live through it with us or don't respond, then you're going to get a different performance. So I think that people know that when they go, that we're all in it together. Now, if you're coming to see a classic play, you're also getting a chance to celebrate, I think, as you do in great sports events, sort of the best of what the human being can do. You're getting to listen to the words and the ideas of an extraordinary mind. If the play is well done, you're seeing a kind of Olympics of acting, Olympics of design, Olympics of hopefully direction. And so that you're getting to see human beings at their very best in this field. I think for me, the most satisfying thing in the world is to see a great production of a classic play. For me, one of the least satisfying things in the world is to see a bad one. I feel that way about the ballet. I'd rather see a great Giselle than anything else, and I'd rather see anything else than a bad Giselle. And that's because I think that you are so conscious of the art and the skill of the artists when you are doing something as extraordinary as that. But, you know, I hope this doesn't offend anybody. When I was reading the New York Times today, and I know this is probably sensitive because some of you knew Kenneth Lay, but or maybe not. But, you know, the thing was, are classics relevant? Was the thing that said here on the brochure. And I came across this morning, I thought, isn't this interesting? Of course, I can't read it. That's because I'm looking at the wrong side. Yeah. This is a statement by somebody named Burton, a Texas lawyer who knew Mr. Lay for more than 10 years. Compared Mr. Lay to Icarus, the figure in Greek mythology who was given wings made of feathers and was and wax, just because it's dark, wax, but fell into the sea when he flew too close to the sun. The Enron and Ken Lay stories are best told in an English literature class or a classics class, Mr. Burroughs told an interview in 2002. Where you are trying to explain what hubris is all about. And I thought that was really interesting, that in trying to deal with, let's say, a quite extraordinary story, much larger than one man's, that to try to even come to understand it in some way, we immediately go to a great classic story. And really, why is that? I mean, we can certainly understand the what happened or didn't happen in a particular event, such as the Enron story or the story of Mr. Lay. But I think what a classics have, what classics do is they deal in the most primal and pure way, and perhaps the most concentrated way, with the absolute deepest issues that affect all of us, and that have affected us throughout history, and deal with them in a form that is beautiful and formal in its own way. And so you have these extraordinary stories of politics, of passion, of man's relation to the universe, of functional and dysfunctional families, of rulers, of fathers, daughters. At their most significant core of those issues. And when you have a genius like Sophocles or Euripides or Aeschylus or Shakespeare, these stories are told in an investigative way. I like to think of these writers as explorers or as scientists. They're not moralists. It's very interesting when you think about Shakespeare or about Euripides. They don't have a point of view. They have questions to ask, and they have problems to explore. And what they ask us to do, if the production does them justice, is ask us to consider those issues for ourselves. For me, a classic is a play written in whatever period. I know there is such a thing as classical, which we understand is coming from either a classical period of Greece or the Renaissance, or perhaps one could say there's certain people considered certain 19th century plays to still be classical. But for me, I'd like to talk about classics. And what is a classic? For me, a classic is a play written in its time, whatever its time, dealing with issues that completely transcend its time. So there are plays of the Elizabethan period that really don't strike us as classics now. They may come from the Renaissance, they may come from what we would consider a classical period, but they deal easily with problems of its time. They have a point of view, they ask questions, and they answer them. And once the play is over and the questions have been answered, in a way, that experience, satisfying as it may be, does not really need to be repeated. But Shakespeare, for instance, simply puts all the questions on the table in a play and none of the answers.
Okay, but a skeptic can say on that, Michael, that, okay, but I can come up with the questions myself. I want answers in life. And, you know, no, I like to go to the library. I like to get out a how-to book, you know, and find out how to be happy, how to lose weight, how to be, you know, influence friends. And so I want to come to classic theater, and I want to walk away with some lessons. Now, what are you going to teach me?
No, I'm going to teach you to think. I'm going to ask you to think for yourself on the issues that have been raised in the evening. Shakespeare, classical plays are not how-tos. They don't tell you how to sleep with your mother, like Oedipus. They don't tell you how to murder the king. They don't tell you how to do that. They ask you to think about what are the basic issues that make those things happen. What are the underlying social, political, emotional, and indeed psychological things that permit these things to happen. And they do them in a form that celebrates the human ability to think and to form language. You can't go to a play to ask to find out what it is you should do. You go to a play to allow you to think better about what it is you might want to do.
Okay, but tell us how to prepare to go to a play to get the most out of it in a classical theater.
I have two answers for that. And they're contradictory. One is the one that everybody likes, which is to read the play first, so that you get over the hard and strange words. My preferred answer is that you be like the audience, the first audience at those plays, and that you arrive just like the first audience at the Globe or the first audience at Epidaurus, and you sit there and you allow this experience to happen to you with its complexity, its difficulties, its ambiguities for the first time. Now, people say, but I won't understand all the words. Not all of Shakespeare's audience understood all the words. As a matter of fact, Shakespeare made up some words, quite a lot of words. I don't understand everything my friends say to me. I don't understand half of what I say to myself. What I mean is, I don't think this need to understand is the same as the need to experience. And these plays were not written, these plays were written for an audience that was both aristocratic and non-aristocratic, educated and non-educated, had read, had not read. It's why the stories are so vivid and the language is so extraordinary. And I prefer people to come without any knowledge and without any preconceptions. And that's the third thing. To experience, I think, a work of art, whatever it is to come and pay attention to it as fully as you can, looking at it as freshly and as freely as you can, not on the basis of, let's say, another performance of the same play you saw, or another performance of this music piece you saw, or another painting that looks like it, but try to experience what you are seeing in the present for the first time. Now, that's very hard. That's very difficult. First of all, it scares us. We feel we need to bring particular knowledge, or we feel we need to be able to be critical in an interesting way, and therefore we say, well, I think when I saw it when I was 15, that's the way this is supposed to be. I think art's supposed to strike you each time freshly, and it can only do that if you bring to it maybe knowledge, maybe understanding, but also a spontaneous ability to see it for the first time. So I feel that about classical plays. I know that it works with kids. I mean, sometimes we do a lot of stuff for kids, and kids come, and sometimes they're prepared, and sometimes they're not prepared. Mm-hmm. And I don't find a huge difference in the audience. I find that the story involves them, something gets them. And by the way, you don't have to get everything in a play. One of the extraordinary things about these plays is they're so rich in complexity, they're so rich in ambiguity, something very difficult for us to live with, that they bear repeated visits.
Tell us, looking back, and I know this is an unfair question in a sense because you haven't thought about it, but tell us two or three magic moments that you had in the theater when you say, you were just blown away by the experience. And then behind that, what made it so magical to you?
Well, Peter Brook's Midsummer Night's Dream, in which was the first time that I saw a production. Peter Brook's Midsummer Night's Dream, in which I saw a production that did not take place in a set that looked like a set, in which a lot of different theatrical conventions, like Asian theater, were being used, where there was a physical life to Shakespeare I'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. I had seen a lot of Shakespeare stand up and talk, and here was a huge physical life, and yet a huge imaginative life, and a huge metaphorical life, which mm-hmm. I liked. Some of the best some of the Giorgio Strehler's Italian version of The Tempest, in which I think he understood, as he was himself a much older man, he understood the magic of the theater in the play as seen from a man who had spent his life in the theater. And so it had both a childlike and completely sophisticated quality. And for me, that actually did that play for me. When the Habima came the first time I saw the Dybbuk in a language I didn't speak, and I saw a fable being told ritualistically. Mm-hmm. When I saw Martha Graham for the first time, when I saw the Kabuki for the first time, when I saw Laurence Olivier dive off a huge platform at the end of Coriolanus to his death, you know, not his own, but Coriolanus's, and thought what courage that took for an actor. And I realized that the whole art of acting is one act of courage.
So in all these experiences, what's in common to all these magic moments?
That's something illuminating.
Surprise?
Surprise and illumination.
Uh-huh.
That's something that I saw something and I understood something that I hadn't understood when I walked in the door of that theater. And finally, that is the purpose of art, which is to change our perceptions if we will allow it to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, it did those things for me.
As a director, how do you do that for an audience? How do you give an audience that experience?
I think all of us who work in the arts can only work from both our intelligence and our soul. I could never get up in the morning and saying, I'm going to have a moment of illumination for you all. I wouldn't be able to get up in the morning. I think everybody would say this, you have to get up and do your work. Mm-hmm. And you have to do your work in the good days when you're inspired, and you have to have the discipline to do your work in the good days when you're not inspired. And you hope that somehow, it's not so much the gods are with you, but somehow you will understand something in a particular way, and you will find a particular way to tell that or explore that or shape that it might reach another person. Mm-hmm. And you can't expect, by the way, to reach everybody the same way. In the same way that actors are all different instruments, an audience is composed of people with different experiences. They bring something to the experience themselves. And so what may illuminate one person or what may be a magical moment for one person may be different for another. When a whole audience feels that way, then that's pretty extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a combination of a lot of things. The audience being willing to go on a journey and giving themselves up to it. The actor or the singer or the musician going on that journey to going past technique into another realm. And when that happens, and that does happen, then what you talk about is the magic of the theater. That is the particular magic of being in the presence of that.
What do you think? Who do you think are the greatest actors today?
Well, I have to work with all of them.
I know. We're not with all of them, so tell us who are the
no,
best.
Best actors.
Pierce the characters and really get to you and get to an audience?
Well, I think, although her work is becoming somewhat more eccentric as the years go on, I've always thought that Vanessa Redgrave was perhaps one of the best actors in the world. I think Meryl Streep in America is, I think, perhaps the best actor we have.
Mm-hmm.
I wish she did more plays.
She's in Mother Courage now.
She's rehearsing now.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are great performances, mm-hmm. which are more important to me than great actors. One of the things about actors is they can be extraordinary in one part and not so extraordinary in another,
mm-hmm.
And so it's performances I remember somewhat more than saying this is a great actor or not. Actors I admire are actors who are imaginative, daring, don't play by the rules, are not safe, willing to go out on a limb, and yet have all the skill to do that. Mm-hmm. So.
Good. Let's open it up for questions. Yeah, right there at the bar, please.
If you look at the Brave New World at all, we find words frequently used like absolute, perfect, great. And we are experiencing from you words like ambiguities, complexity. Do you think art and classical theater have a very important role to play in shaping our mindshift to?
I think it has an important role in shaping what questions you might ask.
But you're saying, Michael, as I take it, that the classical theater asks the basic human questions.
But in a complex way. Mm-hmm. So what is the, I'm sorry, I perhaps didn't understand.
No, that was like, give us an example of something asking a basic question in a complex way.
Well, let's talk about King Lear.
Good.
Well, no, let's talk about Henry V. Let's talk about Henry V. And I'd like to relate some of my experiences with that play, if I may, to perhaps answer your question as a kind of journey of my own in understanding Shakespeare. Many years ago, when I was the director of the American Shakespeare Theater in Stratford, Connecticut, and I had become the artistic director, I wanted to do The Tempest as my opening play. I'm glad I didn't. I think I was way too young to understand The Tempest. But I had an idea about The Tempest, and I went to see Peter Brook's Midsummer Night's Dream in Stratford that afternoon, and there were many things about that production I would have done infinitely less well, but that in certain concepts seemed the same. And so I thought, well, I can't do that, and this production was glorious. So I was staying at a friend's house, actually a well-known teacher, director, and I picked up Henry V. And I had had no interest in Henry V at the time. It was during the Vietnam War. And I had no interest in doing a play that I thought was about war and glorified war. And why did I think that? Because I had seen the rather brilliant film by Laurence Olivier. And so I thought, this is a great nationalist epic, and I don't want to do a play this particular time in a war that I deeply objected to, about a play that was promoting war, because that's what I had understood from the Olivier film. And so I picked up the script, and I was reading it, and I was amazed to find in the first two scenes that these two churchmen, the Bishop of Ely and the Archbishop of Canterbury, were upset that Henry was taxing them. And so they decided that the way to get out of this would be to create a reason for Henry to go to war at France and get out of their hair. And they created a somewhat specious reason to go to war with France. Well, this, as a, you know, a young hippie radical, this was like amazing. Wow. And then I read through the play, and there was Henry killing the French prisoners against the rules of engagement. And I thought, God, what a dreadful man he is. And I really want to do this now. And so I took a look at the Olivier film. Now, I knew the Olivier film had been created, one of the first films made, I think, as the war was happening in Britain, and money was spent, there was very little money available, and that's why the sets were painted, as done to really rouse the English to stand up against the Nazis. And so I thought, where's this little scene, this terrible, cynical, anti-church, anti-wars, where is it? With the bishop, and I realized that he'd set the first part of the play of the movie in the Theater of the Globe. And there were these two funny-looking actors, very famous character, but really funny-looking, with very funny makeup putting it on, being very camp and very bad, doing the Archbishop and the Cardinal. Archbishop and the Cardinal, whatever, Archbishop and the Bishop. So you didn't take it seriously for a moment. Mm-hmm. Not for a moment. And it stayed in the theater until they went to France, and then all of a sudden the glory happened. So I thought, that was very smart. That stuff was all ignored. Mm-hmm. The complexity of the play and the ambiguity of the play was ignored. Now, I was in my 20s, so I went ahead and I went the other way completely. I hit that with a sledgehammer. I hit everything like that hugely. When every time anybody died in the play, they put on a bloody mask and stood there for the whole play.
Oh, is that right?
Absolutely.
My God.
I did the anti-war Henry V. Mm-hmm. Now, I had difficulty with the big speeches. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of difficulty with St. Crispian's Day.
So you just yanked it out of the play?
No, I did it. I did it, but I kept saying it was a political speech. It was a fake. And as a matter of fact, I put little slogans, Brechtian slogans, all the time saying the war machine or the lie is told, all of that.
Isn't that playing down to your audience?
Wait a minute. No. It actually made me famous.
Oh, really?
That might have been why. No. It's a long story to answer your question. I came back to the play 8 years ago.
With Harry
Hammond. An older person, living in Washington, being much more aware of life. And I saw what Shakespeare had really done, which is he's created a play which dealt with the problems of national leadership. And what do you have to do, and what is the price you pay, and what are the compromises perhaps you make, and what is it that you do, or what may you have to do in order to be a leader? Mm-hmm. He's not telling me that Henry is a great guy or a bad guy. He is putting out there all of these issues that create what a king is. That, to me, is the discussion to have after seeing Henry V, not whether it's an anti-war play, whether it's a pro-war play. When you start to make these plays about what you want them to be about only, you squeeze the complexity of these plays like you would squeeze something into a little toothpaste tube. But if you say, I'm going to give the same equal weight to all of the issues and the complications in these plays, then I think a dialogue happens. If the audience is listening, then I think these plays make us ask important questions. You know, is the storm that Lear goes out just a storm like the movie of the perfect storm? Is it really just about a man going out, you know, in the rain? Or is it something about man in relation to a universe that behaves in a certain way, and is that a metaphor for the way he's dealt with his family? Is that a metaphor for the way that he's run his kingdom? Is that a metaphor for what? Is that a metaphor for a man who needs to be cleansed in a way to become a human being? It's not just a play about a storm. Mm-hmm. So, I've had so many experiences. We did the Trojan Women. Now, first of all, we live in a country where there is no political theater to speak of. There are some people, Anna Deavere Smith is here. She's a great person in my mind for the kind of political theater that Anna does. But we really don't have political playwrights. We don't, you know, we have three or four you can mention. Political ideas, social ideas are not really discussed in the modern theater by modern writers for a lot of reasons. However, when you open the Trojan Women, as we did, a 4,000-year-old play by Euripides, and it happens to be on the night that the war starts in Kosovo, people think about Kosovo while they're seeing a Greek play. And they think about the issue of women in war. I have to say, the best thing I ever... This, you'll hate this. We're on different sides politically here.
But it doesn't matter that much.
No, and you know, but I, you know, he's on my board, so he's allowed. We have to have a few of you. So,
token board member.
No, but the truth is that I did a production of Timon of Athens, you remember. Yes. And you liked that production.
I loved it.
Right. And that's a play about Jacobean... That's about Jacobean capitalism, because capitalism was a really important issue for Shakespeare, about the growth of capitalism and the objectifying of money and people as commodities. And that's what The Merchant of Venice is about. It's not really about Jews. It's about a society based on money. We could talk about that if you want. I get in real trouble. So I did Timon of Athens, and so Shakespeare said it. He wanted to talk about Jacobean capitalism, and there was a certain amount of censorship, so he said it in Periclean Athens. Nobody in Elizabethan England knew anything about Periclean economics. I don't know if Shakespeare knew anything about Periclean economics, but the audience saw it, and they must have realized it was about Elizabethan economics and what happens when there's a bust. So I did it in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. I thought it was important to do. We'd had a bust, and I thought we were getting greedy again, and everybody's having their swimming pools again, and there's a lot of stuff going on that I remembered from 10 years earlier. So I thought, maybe I'll do Timon of Athens, and I'll just set it in the 80s, because I did exactly what Shakespeare did. Shakespeare said it, something that would be more familiar. I just said it because I wanted to just remind everybody that a boom and a bust seemed to come together, and we were forgetting the lessons of 10 years ago. So I got a letter in the mail, a very irate letter in the mail, with 4 subscriptions torn up, saying, this was during the Clinton-Dole election. 4 subscriptions torn up saying, you're trying to influence the election. Now I thought, I hadn't even thought about that. But I wrote her back saying, that was the best letter I ever got from anybody. To think that a 450-year-old play could make you so angry politically about something, that wasn't me, that was Shakespeare. But Shakespeare had gotten exactly to what it was like with a society that thought money was the most important thing, with a man who thought money was the most important thing, and what happened to him in that society when he didn't have it anymore. And he was now an outcast. Mm-hmm. So, now she thought I was doing about Reaganomics. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about Reaganomics. Mm-hmm. She actually wrote me and said, why didn't you use Clinton? I said, well, if I was going to think about sex and something, I would, but this was a play about money. Anyway, what were you saying?
All right, now let's go to our second question and try to keep your questions a little shorter. Okay?
And I'll make my answers shorter.
I just wanted to ask,
Jan?
I think all of us are so worried about the future of theater in the world.
Yeah.
In the United States, you see how much it costs to stage something in New York City. Yeah. When I went to New York for 10 days last spring just to see theater, and I have to say I was really disappointed.
Yeah.
I saw Proof, and I loved Cherry Jones, and she went up.
You were at one of those magical moments.
I loved it. It was fun, because she came in, just a minute, I was on page 22, let me go back now. And it was really fun watching her do that. But
what happened?
London,
tell us again what happened.
Cherry Jones and Proof.
Right.
She went up.
What do you mean, went up?
She lost her lines.
Forgot her lines.
Oh, really?
She forgot her lines.
Doubt. Thank you, doubt. Doubt. She went up, and I've never seen an actress say, excuse me, I'm sorry, I forgot my lines, I'm not feeling well today.
I had a friend who was at that performance.
Oh, yeah. It was really
maybe
fun.
It was more than one performance.
And for this you pay $70?
Right. I love that, and that was fabulous. Spamalot was great. And when I go to London, I feel more turned on, though. And I'm wondering, is it because it is government funded theater, and are we going to have to go to that? And what do you? I just want to ask you. Sorry, long question. What do you see about the future?
Well, let me just say that I don't consider that the theater in America is just Broadway. So what you want to say about Broadway, you can say really, quite frankly, now about the West End in London. You can actually, unfortunately, say it about Prague. I mean, when theater is solely commercial, then it has to live by certain specific commercial rules, and it lives and dies by the marketplace. There's nothing wrong about that. But as you say, the costs of putting on a play on Broadway are quite large, and the costs of going to it are quite high. And so the idea of serious plays and or taking a chance on certain things is infinitely more risky on Broadway. On the other hand, there is more theater in America than there has been ever before. Now, that means there are major theaters in all cities, good theaters in smaller cities, and theater has become decentralized in a really good way. Actors don't feel they have to just work in New York. They can work many places. Great plays are done more frequently outside of New York than in New York. And almost the only place where new plays get a chance are outside of New York or sometimes off Broadway. And if you take a look at New York theater, you will see that plays, Proof was done in an off-Broadway theater, Doubt was done in an off-Broadway theater, a lot of plays that are there now were done at regional theaters, that the theater is more alive outside of Broadway as a creative force than it ever has. Now, one more answer to that question. I don't believe that theater in the future has to be what theater was before. It doesn't, when people say the theater is dying, perhaps the theater is redefining itself in a different society. It doesn't have to be, it no longer is the only entertainment you can have. It is, you know, but it is going to be the only entertainment of its kind that you can have. And so perhaps there will be less of it. I hope it will get to be cheaper. There are a lot of reasons to try to make that happen. And I hope that it will begin to see that what it does specially is what it should do. I don't think it should try to compete with the movies. I think the idea of these huge spectacle plays, they're wonderful. They're fun to spend $110 for in the theater. But they are not the future of the theater. Special effects and that are the future of films and video. And I think theater has to see itself as a very human experience. And I would like to think as a both challenging and entertaining experience. I think theater should begin to see itself as something that offers something richer, something more complicated, something that requires more work on the part of the audience than what they can get sitting at home on television.
Let me pick up on what Michael says on outside of New York, because we love the Washington Shakespeare Theater. But we go every year, as you know, Jan, to the Utah Shakespeare Theater in Cedar City, Utah. We have 55 people go with us. This was our 18th year. And I'm telling you, we have quality of theater in this very small, very backwards, very isolated, very desolate city. It has 6 plays in repertoire. The quality is sensational. The acting is sensational. Dana Gioia has been with us for many years. There's Dana. And he's coming again with his family when we go there in the beginning of April. But it is just one, I'm not playing favorites, but that's our favorite, if you want to know, aside from Washington. But I'm just saying that kind of quality in the middle of the desert in Utah is just thrilling to see. And
I love Chicago theater. I mean, I'm really a fan of Chicago. You're in town, came from
right.
I just love Chicago theater. I love the Goodman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you don't know, for instance, Washington, D.C. has 65 theaters. Mm. You just don't know that.
No, my daughter saw Trojan Women when she was very young, and she still has the playbill in her bedroom, and it really moved her.
That man had a question over there.
Okay, please.
If I'm a 12-year-old kid, why is classical theater relevant?
Well, I think, let me put it another way. Let me put it that if it's taught badly in your school, it will never be. Yeah. There's nothing. If a 12-year-old kid is given a chance to see a play, and I think I have the evidence for this, let's say a play of Shakespeare, I think they will answer that question pretty much to you. If they have been taught it badly, if they have been made to feel intimidated by it in school, if they have made to look up all the words, I think they should see a play first. And then I think they answer their own question. And I mean that sincerely. I'm not trying to cop out on this question. I think why young people begin not to like Shakespeare at all or anything like that is the way it's given to them first. It should be given to them as a play first and not as a school exercise. And I believe that. There is no kid that I think will see Romeo and Juliet without feeling connected to that play.
Yep. Please.
Suggesting that Shakespeare transcends modernity. And I think what's more interesting is the fact that the base conditions of the human personality are not...
Haven't changed. Yeah.
They haven't changed. I think as a country we've changed in terms of freedoms and egalitarian concepts, but when it comes to the base drives of the human condition, it's non-transcendent. And so in a way, Shakespeare maybe was just comprehensive, almost biblical, in terms of the breadth of addressing that. What I'm curious is there a modern playwright who does it as well as Shakespeare, identifying the pettiness of the human condition?
I would, if you ask me I would say that if I'm trying to talk about classic theater, I would include Beckett, I would include Genet, I would include, I think Williams, some plays of Tennessee Williams are going to be our classic plays that transcend their time. I didn't say they transcend modernity. They transcend the time that they're written in because of the discussion of the human condition in them that actually transcends that. And I think some of you, O'Neill, I don't think every play of Shakespeare's is classic. I don't think Comedy of Errors and Two Gentlemen of Verona, they're chanting, they're funny, and if they're done well, they're wonderful. But I don't consider them, in that sense, the same kind of play as Lear or Hamlet or Twelfth Night. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I think Shakespeare teaches us in many of the plays, especially in the darker plays like All's Well and Winter's Tale, and that's a lesson I think we all need to learn, is that those plays end in reconciliation. And sometimes I think that theater can provide you with asking yourself the questions about the most difficult things, and it also can provide you with the alternatives to the way we live. And for me, sometimes Shakespeare does that too, that in the midst of the horror of The Winter's Tale, finally there is understanding and forgiveness. And in a world where I think forgiveness is lacking, and horror exists, I think those are valuable lessons to have. I feel that when I see a great Mozart opera too. So I think classics keep redefining, what is a classic keeps growing. And so I don't like to use the word classical anymore. Is that what you meant?
Well, I was just wondering, in the modern era, are there any writers, scholars, who are treating this topic, which is kind of the core issues of the human nature, human condition? I mean, like, what plays would you say are of the same caliber? Are there modern classics? What would you consider the modern classics?
Well, I would certainly think Beckett. I would agree with you about Beckett. I think the best play, probably.
Yeah, I was going to say Stoppard, too. Would you say Stoppard?
Edward Albee?
I would say that depending upon what play now, I think probably Virginia Woolf. I mean, I shouldn't be just like, I feel like Ropert, you know, and Ebert, you know, and I don't like doing that. I would say that Virginia Woolf is probably a play that will live for a very long time because that's probably as essential as Dance of Death or something in terms of a particular discussion of relationships. That's not true about all of Edward Albee's plays. As I said, it's not true about all of Shakespeare's plays. It's not true about O'Neill's plays. O'Neill's plays, I think, will live many of them because the ambition in those plays is so huge, like Wagner, what he wants to talk about, what he wants to put on the stage, how he wants to put on is even maybe larger than his own technical grasp. So there's a certain clumsiness in the writing, where there's a certain godlike magnificence in the attempt, you know. You know what makes me sad? I wish that the Library at Alexandria hadn't burned down. Can you imagine what that would have been like?
Yeah.
We would be having such a different conversation.
Yeah, that's fascinating. But the idea on the reconciliation that Michael has really taught us over the years gave rise and inspiration. Carol and I are going to do a 3-day seminar in September on forgiveness and using The Tempest as, I think, a kind of classic case of someone very, very torn on whether to forgive or not to forgive, and to work that out. And so we're looking forward to exploring this idea.
Well, I think that play could be a lesson in the end of violence.
I think
the best play about that would be the Oedipus cycle, which is really about violence as a cycle repeats itself. There are a lot of questions. So
okay. Yeah, we're going to have just...
This is cool.
I know, but this is cool. But people have to go, and we started at 7 o'clock in the morning, so it's not so cool. We'll do 1, 2...
I got up at 6 to get here.
3, 4... I'll ask your questions, and then Michael will sort them out, okay? 1, 2, go on.
I wanted to draw on Michael's experience, but also yours, Ken, as an arms control expert.
Oh, please. Concentrate on Michael. He's too valuable.
No. I wish there was a little more Shakespeare being read.
My question is what the classics and the ancients tell us, or what questions they raise about tyranny, which was so central to so many of their plays, and of course central today.
Mm-hmm. Hold it. Go on, please.
I had another question about the 12-year-old kid thing as a student. Who do you think, whose job is it to teach people about classics? Because I've had wonderful experiences seeing plays in school, but then my entire ninth grade class went to see Romeo and Juliet, and it was the worst audience I've ever sat through. What an amazing production. Uh-huh. Because of that, it was a horrible play, and just whose job is it?
Why was it the worst audience?
People just were talking throughout the whole thing and jeered at the audience, and I felt...
Well, then maybe, I think we live in a television generation now where people talk anyway. So perhaps there are just little rules that have to be.
Yeah.
Little rules have to be done. I just want to answer that one quickly.
Okay.
May I?
Sure.
We just opened The Persians by Aeschylus. Mm-hmm. And that's a play written by Aeschylus set on the night that the Persians find out that they have lost, the greatest empire in the world being defeated by a very small republic. And it's done rather brilliantly from the side of the Persians. And if there was any play that talks about the need for nations to think, you saw it.
No, sir.
And national hubris, and Aeschylus. Aeschylus had a great big meaning in Washington 2 months ago. Just like Measure for Measure had a whole lot to say during the NEA controversy. Mm-hmm. It had a lot to say, and it still does.
Okay, there are a few more questions here. Yeah, 1, 2.
It's not really on this skip.
Okay, please.
I wondered what you thought about people who have written on Shakespeare, like Harold Goddard and Harold Bloom, and Bloom's idea of invention of human.
Well, I almost disagree with Harold Bloom most of the time. So it's a really cool conversation. I tell you what I do. I read the... Look, I know, I've seen plays a lot, and I'm not dumb. So I get kind of... it's hard for me to... I try to read a play by Shakespeare the same way I asked you to do it. As though I've never heard it before, I've never seen it before. I don't know anything about it. That takes a lot of doing in my... I have to keep throwing things away, and I try to keep coming to the play freshly. After I feel I really, 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 as best as I can, think I've come into some contact with the author's mind and what I think the play's about and what he's talking about and why he's doing it in this particular way, then I enjoy reading scholars because they either support what I feel, or they make me think something else, or by disagreeing violently with them, I know that I actually have an idea. But, you know, criticism's an industry like anything else. The thing I wish scholars would do would be to evolve their thinking as much as artists do. I know that somebody coming to a play 3 or 4 times, a director, an actor, will find that they'll change their ideas about the play. Sometimes I wish the scholars would as they get older, mm-hmm. and not just beat the same particular.
We're going to take you as the last question, but I'm going to be the next to last question. You're going to be the last question. Mine is going to be to Dana Joy. Give us 30 seconds, Dana, on the state of theater in America. Do you agree with Michael that it's flourishing, you know, not necessarily in New York? Or what do you think?
No one is sure how many... I think I can hear me with my foot. Nobody is sure how many theaters there are in the United States. I mean, it's really quite interesting because there's always somebody creating a new one. There's always another one closing down. And, you know, we have somewhere around 3,000 theaters going to the United States right now. They're doing all kinds of interesting stuff. I think, I mean, Michael's exactly right. New plays are not happening in New York generally anymore. If they're enormously successful, they may end up there eventually. And so I think we have a very thriving scene of talent. I do think that to a certain degree, playwrights have retreated a little bit, and they're writing smaller and smaller plays.
Is that financially driven, Dana?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's financially driven. It's also because if you have movies there, a play's got to be different from the movies.
I see.
I think the plays are now much more about talk, less about action. They're much more about what can we do in a small... a small cast. And so you have a different set of ambition that are going on there. And that's, I think, still evolving in some ways.
I think it's partly financial. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you would give it an A?
The thing that worries me is demographics. Mm. You look at theater audiences, there's a small decline, but there's a huge decline among younger patrons. And, you know, and that's why one of the reasons NEA, we're investing so much in terms of developing, teenagers going into the theater. Because I worry about where American theaters can be in 20 years. Because to a certain degree, what Michael said there, and I think it's what you were saying in a different way about Michelle, is that what the excitement of live theater is the dialectic between the audience and the actors. Mm-hmm. And when that dialectic begins to, you know, one half of it begins to get weak, then it affects the other half.
Also, if there's not arts education in schools, then this is a moot question. You know, no child should be left behind with the arts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our last question, please.
It kind of relates a little bit to what Dana just said, but I have a passion for classical literature, and I've done some things to try to bring some of it alive on stage. And I'm running into the problem in regional theaters, in particular, the very thing of they want that snappy two-character, one-set, David Mamet kind of play, and I find, just try to make that relevant, that some of the classic literature would make incredible theater, and it's difficult, and I just didn't know if you had any thoughts on that. Or.
Well, there are, where are you trying to do this?
In LA.
In LA. Move. There's no theater in L.A. to speak of. You know what I mean. You know what I mean. There's very little dedication in that sense.
How about the...
You know what
this?
I mean.
The Getty?
I love L.A.
The new Getty, the villa, that just is invaluable.
Nobody can
do it. Oh, you mean do it there?
Nobody will do it, though.
What?
Nobody wants to actually do theater like
that. They're doing Greek theater, a magnificent performance.
Okay, no, Arlene has a comment. Arlene? You have to speak loud.
We have 11 sets of theater tickets. Every year we have to decide which ones to pick up and which ones we just can't make because we travel. These are not Broadway shows. We are seeing so much original theater in New York. I mean, for all of you who think you have to go out of New York, the problem is when the tourists come, they want to go to the Broadway shows, and then they say, it's just a big fluffy show. You've got to hit those off-Broadway shows. That's where the great.
That's what I said. That's where you're going to find it's going
to be. You don't have to go out of New York to do that. And there's enough density in New York that these theaters are full.
Right. I was trying to say that people think the theater's dying because Broadway's not the same. Right.
Right. Right.
And Chester, loud.
The theater in New York is thriving because it has a positive economic setup because first it has subscriptions, so it has its loyal members who will come to all of the shows, and there are many donations that are given to these theaters.
Would you go to Manhattan Theater Club and round about all of them? Good for you.
They have 11.
Good. 11 sets of season tickets.
All right, our last comment, and then we're going to thank Michael.
I thought we were gone.
Go on. Loud, make it loud. Okay, the question is back to your advice of seeing a show like you're looking at it for the first time. How do you go about doing that?
Sit there and open yourself to it. I mean that seriously. Just be there, and be there with all of your senses. Be there. It's as simple as that, I believe. It's all the other stuff, you know, leave your day behind and be there.
Thank you, Michael Kahn. Very good. That was very good. You did a great job.